CityCast from Explore City.
My mother and I went by train to Bombay. I boarded SS Cilicia and found myself standing next to an utterly subdued character. I had been introduced to him and his parents on the dock. He had merely nodded his head in a distant manner. As the ship shuddered and set sail, the figures waving farewell to us from the shore grew smaller and smaller. Suddenly, a voice demanded, "Do you think the bastards can see us?" "I don't think so," I replied, at which he casually pulled out a pack of cigarettes from some hiding place and, lighting one up, invited me to a drink at the bar. I got the impression that he didn't emerge from the bar until we docked at Liverpool. But before you laugh, note that he went on to become one of the most well-known advertising executives in India. Barely had we had lunch from an incomprehensible continental menu when the ship began to lurch and heave. I took to my bunk until we reached Karachi some 36 hours later. Thereafter, either the sea got calmer or we had discovered our sea leg. But I certainly enjoyed the journey to Aden more. By the time we got to Suez, we were all seasoned sailors. Some of us took the tour to the pyramids, where my most vivid memory is of being put on a pair of camels called Whiskey and Soda. We then headed to Port Said and caught up with our fellow passengers at a sleazy nightclub where the principal dancer was the spitting image of Jacqueline Kennedy. Somebody, I'd rather think it was I, made the mistake of saying so a little too loudly, and a hulking American seaman rolled up at our table threateningly. "You're talking about our first lady." We apologized, cut, and ran. On board were two friends from St. Stephen, Indal Tayebji and Jitin Daulat Singh, and my classmate from Doon, Harpreet Singh Sandhu, who was going further to the US. I also made friends with an East Pakistani, Haq Chowdhury, who gave me a glimpse into the concerns of the Bangladeshis that were to boil over in the years to come. A lot of time was spent hanging out with a young thing from Kenya called Kokila. There was a Sindhi lady from Bombay who said I could make some pin money by writing about my adventures in Cambridge in her magazine. This was on the assumption that there were going to be any adventures. And there was a Dr. Prem and his British wife, settled in England for many years, who were returning home after their annual vacation in India. The steward, who was busy organizing passenger concerts, had some fun at Kokila's expense, as she spiritedly sang the 1950s hit song, "I've Got a Lovely Bunch of Coconuts." He interjected, "However, have a banana."
My guest today is the remarkable Manishankar Iyer. If you haven't heard of him, let's just simply admit that you've been living under a rock. But if you have been anywhere near the worlds of diplomacy or politics or literature, you will know of him in detail. But let me sum up his remarkable journey as succinctly as I can. He joined the Foreign Service in 1963. He went on to become the Consul General of India in Karachi in Pakistan in 1978 through 1982. His path took a significant turn when he was invited to join the Prime Minister's office in 1985 at the behest of then Prime Minister Rajiv Gandhi. In 1989, he made a pivotal decision to leave the Foreign Service and dive headfirst into politics. He ran for Member of Parliament and won the Mayiladuthurai constituency in Tamil Nadu in 1991 as a candidate from the Congress Party. Over the years, he has seen the highs and lows of it all. He lost his seat in 1996 and 1998 and regained it in 1999 and again in 2004. Manishankar Iyer is more than a diplomat or politician. He's what you might call a man of words and ideas, with a deep well of knowledge and a vast literary appetite. He is what I might term a true intellectual, and I know him for his unfiltered and honest expression, which has sometimes landed him in hot water, causing his own party, the Congress Party, to distance himself from his candid remarks. His sense of humor is decidedly Woodhouseian, and he is nothing if not completely hilarious on demand. In one interview, he spoke of his early Marxist leanings and being investigated by Indian intelligence for it. Of this, he said, "I think the intelligence bureau ultimately came to the conclusion that I was indeed a Marxist, but of the Groucho variety." For all his education in India's most prestigious school and a career in the best places in administration, Iyer remains a socialist. He believes that the real and equitable development of India can only happen ground up from the villages. To this end, the country created the Ministry of Panchayati Raj for him, and he was its first minister. Iyer's book, Memoirs of a Maverick, is a delightful journey through the first 50 years of his illustrious career, offering glimpses into different facets of his life and, of course, a slew of extremely interesting anecdotes. It's the sort of book that you can read in one sitting. I know, because recently I had the honor of being invited to have a conversation with him at the Bookworm bookstore in Bangalore. I got a call from the bookstore just after lunchtime asking if I will interview Manishankar Iyer at 6 p.m. And they sent his book over to my house so I could read it before then. It was a delightful read, and later a completely delightful session that left me with a deeper appreciation for his wisdom and experience. Today, I am again honored to host him, this time on my podcast. So here he is joining me from his home in Delhi, diplomat, politician, columnist, and author of many books, Manishankar Iyer. Welcome to the Literary City.
Thank you so much.
Let's jump straight in with Pakistan. Now, you write that what you discovered in Pakistan, your experiences were very different from what you expected. What about the Pakistanis? Weren't their heads filled with similar misconceptions about India?
Actually, I was astonished at their reaction, for none of them talked in the terms which you just suggested. They were all very keen on India. They were all deeply concerned that we may attack them, as the military action that we had undertaken only a few years earlier in Bangladesh. But they wanted to avoid that. They had all been through the bombing of Karachi, particularly the oil depots that remained on fire for nearly a week after our Air Force had bombed them and lit up the sky right through the night and the day. And they were aware of how vulnerable they were in the event that India decided on military action. And at a personal level, they had so... You see, Karachi is the city of Mahajirs, that is, those who went from India to Pakistan. And they'd left behind many, many, many relatives. So much so that I issued as many as 3 lakh visas while I was in 3 years in Karachi. And all of these visits were really to meet relatives and some older friends. And I think it needs to be brought on record that I did not get a single police complaint about any one of those visas being misused.
So what was the nature of your initial misconceptions?
I was concerned that as an Indian, I would be treated with suspicion. Mm-hmm. I never expected the kind of welcome and affection and indeed embrace that I received from all kinds of Pakistanis.
Do you have an example?
My very first encounter with Pakistanis, within an hour of my arrival, the phone rang, my clerk picked it up, and said it was a call from the office of the deputy commissioner of Sakkar.
Huh.
No, Indian district magistrates don't ring foreign diplomats.
Right.
But since the man had called, I picked up the phone.
Mm-hmm.
He was in a terrible state. Of course, we spoke in Hindustani, but I'm going to translate what we said in English since this is a program in English. And he said to me, "Sir, I have a terrible problem on my hands." So I said, "How can I help?" And he said, "Because of your minister, L.K. Advani, a Hindu sant has come to Pakistan for the first time since 1965 to the ashram that he used to have in Upper Sindh at a place called Saad Bela, just a little east of the town of Sakkar." I said, "Yes." He said, "Sir, what do I do? His Muslim murids want to meet your Hindu saint." So I listened, astonished. And I said, "Yes." He said, "Sir, can you give me permission to permit his Muslim disciples to meet your Hindu sant?" And I rather grandiloquently gave him permission to do so. That was my first job in Karachi. And can you imagine this gentleman ringing the Chinese embassy, ringing the UK consulate, ringing the American consulate? No, because he really couldn't see any difference between a Pakistani bureaucrat and an Indian bureaucrat.
Interesting.
And when I issued my 100,000th visa, the people waiting in the visiting hall burst into slogans. They said, "Hindustan ke consul general, Zindabad, Zindabad."
Mm-hmm.
It was an astonishing display of affection towards a consulate that, in a humanitarian way, was considering their real family problems and assisting them in meeting their friends and family back in India. Indeed, when P.V. Narasimha Rao visited Pakistan as the Foreign Minister of India, I went to the Hyderabad colony to see whether any of them would be interested in meeting him. And I was astonished when dozens of them said, "Oh, Narasimha Rao to hamare saath school mein padte the." They didn't realize that Narasimha Rao is a very common Hindu name in Telangana. And they all thought that the Narasimha Rao with whom they'd studied was the Foreign Minister of India. So these kinds of experiences I did not have in Hanoi. I did not have in Baghdad. I didn't have in Brussels. I didn't even have in Dhaka, where I was first exposed to the atrocities of the East Pakistanis, or the atrocities to which the East Pakistanis were subjected. So it gave me a completely different perspective on Pakistan to the one that I had nurtured until I reached Karachi. And it makes me convinced that the people of Pakistan are our single biggest asset in that country.
You have always recommended a pragmatic and sensible approach to our foreign policy with Pakistan towards peace, and that's well known. This line from your book: "While we are sure-footed in Paraguay, we stumble in Pakistan."
We do. We've been stumbling for 75 years. And what is the worst thing we do is that when we want to take it out on the Pakistan government, we take it out on the people of Pakistan. They are prevented from coming to our country. They are prevented from coming on religious pilgrimages. They are prevented from seeing India's Muslim heritage. They went away, but they left behind all the treasures of the entire Muslim era from 711 AD to 1858 AD. So I think we make a huge mistake when we place obstacles in the way of people-to-people relations. And I think that is the solid basis on which we should build a dialogue with Pakistan. And today I warn, I'm using the word advisedly, the Chinese are no longer behind the Himalaya, as they have been for all these years. They have now entered Pakistan, and they're standing on the Indus at almost the exact point where Alexander was in 326 BC. So our two so-called enemies have come together. And I believe the primary task of India's foreign policy should be to establish viable relations with both Pakistan and China so that these two so-called enemies can at least become neutral friends of ours, if not close friends.
Towards that, when you were Consul General in Karachi, you sort of put your money where your mouth was. And you walked the extra mile and created this whole visa initiative that you write about extensively and mentioned earlier today. There's a rather poignant story about the last 10 of the first 1 lakh visas that you issued.
Yeah. Well, I must say, before I begin an answer, that it was they who walked the last mile. Don't forget, it was Zia's Pakistan.
Right.
They were all under surveillance. Mm-hmm. And yet, nobody, literally nobody, neither the person who became Prime Minister later, Ghulam Mustafa Jatoi, nor Bhutto's best friend, Hafiz Pirzada, nor any of Shahbaz Mazari, nor any of the other politicians, ever closed their door on me. And I was welcomed even by the Jamaat-e-Islami mayor of Karachi. So it was they who were walking the last mile. But to come back to the story you asked me to recount, when I reached 99,990 visas, I invited 10 Pakistani journalists into my office to act as the visa clerks for handing out the last 10 passports before we reached 1 lakh, the visas. And they did so. And when the 1 lakh visa was attained, I handed over a tin of Darjeeling tea to the winner, and I forgave him his visa fee. And it was at that point that the slogans I mentioned earlier started bursting out. And the Pakistanis didn't trust me. They loved me. I'm told by people who go to Pakistan today, 40 years after I've left Karachi, and with so many of my friends then dead or ill, that almost the first question they're asked is, how is Manishakaraya? So it is entirely possible to follow Gandhi's example and give love and receive love in exchange. If you give hate, you're bound to receive hate in exchange. So what we need is not a Manishankaraya solution to the Pakistan problem. We need a Mahatma Gandhi solution to the Pakistan issue.
You mentioned love and hate, and there's humor. You tend to couch a lot of your pedagogy in humor, in very relatable, folksy incidents. And I'm referring to this one incident, which is on the subject that we have been discussing so far, about this gentleman who wanted a visa to come to India, but used the services of a tout.
Well, it was before the visa office opened, when my security guard came to me and said, there's a man outside who's beating his breast and wailing, tearing his hair, and saying he must get a visa because his mother is dying. And would I please receive the man? So making an exception, I said, bring him up to my office. So the man came holding a telegram, which he placed on the table before me, and was wailing away, ki meri maa mar rahi hai, meri maa mar rahi hai, mujhe unse jaakar milna hai. So I glanced at the telegram and I said, if you tell me where you got this telegram from, I'll give you a visa. So this, ek is gussat ki kya, kya matlab hai? So I said, ki aap keh rahe hain ki aapki maa mar rahi hai, लेकिन इस टेलीग्राम पर लिखा है फादर सीरियस. एट विच पॉइंट द टीयर्स जस्ट वेंट बैक इनटू द डक्स ऑफ हिज आईज एंड ही ग्रैब्ड द टेलीग्राम एंड सेड दैट हिंदू बास्टर्ड. आई सेड व्हाट हिंदू बास्टर्ड. He said there's a Hindu visa pimp standing outside your office, and because he has connections to the Hindu clerks, he says that he can get a visa which would otherwise be refused. So I gave him the visa and had the Hindu pimp removed. I may have to suffer imprisonment in today's India because of that act.
Yes. Right. And then you joined the Prime Minister's office and you worked closely with Rajiv Gandhi. Now, was there a substantive difference in our foreign policy and our relations with Pakistan when Rajiv Gandhi was Prime Minister?
It was a sea change because his mother had been through the horrors of Ayub Khan's rule, had helped in the liberation of East Pakistan from West Pakistan, and the creation of a new country called Bangladesh, which effectively destroyed the two-nation theory, and was very, very against dictators, military dictators, like her father was, for fear that the Napoleon virus might seep into the Indian army. So her relationship, unlike Morarji's, with Zia was very poor. But Zia was so keen on legitimizing his rule by having a good relationship with India that he visited us 6 times without a reciprocal visit. And Rajiv Gandhi, in an interview he gave after he ceased being Prime Minister, while he was Prime Minister, he was bound by the oaths of secrecy, so he couldn't say things. But after he resigned, he said that he had met Zia-ul-Haq 6 times in his first year at various different international venues. And that when Zia came to India on the 17th of December, 1985, that is approximately a year after Rajiv Gandhi had assumed office by winning a huge electoral victory, he said that he almost came. He said they signed an agreement which dealt with the gamut of India-Pakistan problems, giving priority to Siachen. And he added in that interview that if Zia had not been killed by the case of exploding mangoes in that aircraft over Bahawalpur in August 1988, that he was expected to visit India at about that time in order to sign a peace agreement on Siachen. And then he added that it's always easier to deal with military rulers, dictators, who have a strong government than to deal with civilians, and he was referring to Benazir Bhutto, who don't have a strong government because they can't keep to their promises, whereas military generals can. So quite contrary to the conventional view of the Ministry of External Affairs, we need to deal with whoever is in power in Pakistan, military or civil. And the chances of our winning, as proved by Ayub Khan over the Indus Waters Treaty, as proved by Zia over the nearly signed agreement on Siachen, as proved by Pervez Musharraf over his four-point formula for Kashmir, is that it's more likely that we can arrive at an agreement with a military dictator than with an unstable civil government.
Right. Much has been said about the shaky relationship that Benazir Bhutto had with her generals. And I wanted to ask you, you had a ringside seat to this. There was an incident that appears to have been forgotten pretty much. And it had to do with the flashpoint that was reached between India and Pakistan in 1988, when we received some intelligence from the US that Pakistan were outfitting their F-16s to deliver dirty bombs, if I recall that's what it was. and Peter Galbraith came into it. You were there.
Well, the fact of the matter is that Rajiv Gandhi knew better than Homi Sethna and General Sundarji that the Pakistanis were on their way to acquiring a nuclear bomb. And the reason he presented his action plan before the United Nations on the 9th of June 1988 was principally because if the world as a whole did not go in for universal nuclear disarmament, the Pakistanis would make the bomb and India would be obliged to respond. In actual fact, India made the bomb and the Pakistanis responded in just 3 weeks.
Right.
So it was in that situation that Peter Galbraith, who was a very close personal friend of Benazir's, and therefore not entirely to be trusted with delicate diplomatic maneuvers. It's always wrong to go to personal friends. It has to be professionals.
Right.
So anyway, Peter Galbraith also brought to our notice and to Benazir's notice that the Pakistani army was heading towards making a nuclear bomb and that they were going to get whatever assistance they could from the Americans, who had just started their war in Afghanistan, which they incidentally lost after a quarter of a century, proving that they're absolutely useless imperialists. They were the ones who were trying to reward Zia by giving him all kinds of weapons. Well, we were well aware of it, and that is why Rajiv Gandhi had gone for the Bofors gun, because it could shoot and scoot, thereby avoiding Pakistani radar, which had been supplied to them by the Americans. So he was a realist, but he knew that the only lasting solution to India-Pakistan relations was friendship with Pakistan, not matching gun for gun and bomb for bomb and nuclear weapon for nuclear weapon. That is a self-destructive way, which is why he thought he could deal with Benazir. But Benazir was prime minister only for a period of about a year and a half before she was overthrown. And Rajiv himself was prime minister only for 6 months or 5 months after he went to Pakistan. So he didn't really have an opportunity to build up a relationship with Benazir, but he was aware that since she was hopelessly dependent on the Pakistan army, whereas Zia was the Pakistan army, it would perhaps have been easier to cut the Gordian knot with Zia as a military man than with an unstable civilian government.
I get it. Moving slightly forward from Pakistan to Rajiv Gandhi, you mentioned relationships. You were at school with him, but on page 262, you say that you weren't exactly the besties and BFFs as everyone believes.
Well, I wasn't at all even an acquaintance of his. You see, we are in school for 5 to 6 years, and Rajiv was 3 years junior to me. Which inevitably meant, I don't know whether you went to boarding school, but if you're in school for 5 years and somebody is 3 years junior to you, you don't know him, but he knows you.
Certainly.
And therefore, Rajiv knew me. But I didn't know Rajiv. And it was a school where you did not give a damn who was the father of which boy. So Rajiv was treated just like any other schoolboy. And the only time I had anything to do with Rajiv, who, as I said, was 3 years junior to me, was after I passed my senior Cambridge exam and went back to school for one term before joining St. Stephen's College. As a senior, I was permitted to swim at any time. And junior boys had to have the permission of a senior to swim outside the designated hours. And I have this memory, very clear, of a young man, a young boy, very embarrassed, walking up to me with his right toes, scratching his left ankle and saying, "Yaar, give us permission to swim, yaar." And the normal senior reaction would have been to say, "Fuck off." But thank God, I actually gave him permission. And I've often wondered after that, if I'd refused him permission, would he have taken me into his office? But it was only on a purely professional basis, because he had been informed of the work that I was doing with the Sikh diaspora outside India after Operation Blue Star, and thought it was an excellent job. So did his mother. They really both praised me, that I happened to be taken into his office. And I got to know him only as Prime Minister. And the proof of that is, I never, ever called him Rajiv. I always called him Sir. I was never invited to his home. I only had a meal with him when we were on tours, and even that occasionally. And he never came to my home except to condole my mother's death in July 1988. So we weren't bum chums. We weren't any kind of friends. My relationship with him was that of a joint secretary to a prime minister. But because he thought I was competent, and because we shared a similar social, educational background, and because he enjoyed my jokes and I enjoyed his sense of humor, we got on well. But it was a purely professional relationship and did not last beyond his death.
I recall I was a lobbyist for some years in Delhi, and I met you in your office, not that you'd remember, but this was the time that I was meeting, I had to meet Rajiv Gandhi, because he had asked my company to furnish him with reports on a particular issue every month. And when it was all done and we did it successfully, I asked if he would do us the grace of visiting the silicon metal plant in Mettur, and he says yes. But I had to check with you because you were organizing a political tour of some sort, and I had to check in with you because you were putting a schedule together. Made me very happy. Then I came to meet you, and then you had organized his visit. And then I met you in Mettur.
Mettur, oh, of course. Yes. I remember that. I remember that visit very vividly.
I was there.
Well, as Harinder Baweja in India Today described me, she said, "Manishankar Iyer is no more than Rajiv Gandhi's manager tours and travels."
So you not very charitable.
You also took an absolutely accurate view of my role.
No, that was only related to my one experience of meeting you at the same time that I met him. But I do remember, after he died, reading your rather touching Goodnight Sweet Prince article in Sunday Magazine, wasn't it?
It was in Sunday Magazine.
And it spoke of a closeness that you had felt towards him. And it was reflective of all the years that you had spent with him. And it clearly meant a lot to you.
Well, it still means a lot to me. I think Rajiv Gandhi has been more or less forgotten by the Congress. He's very rarely invoked, except in a ritual manner. His policies are not referred to. His heritage is not referred to. I'm not talking about the BJP manifesto. I'm talking about Congress statements. His term as Prime Minister was only 5 years, and it ended more than 30 years ago. And he lived as leader of the opposition for only 18 months. And my article about him, which ended with the words, "Good night, sweet prince," which is a quote from Hamlet, was picked up by a real vixen of a woman journalist. I won't give you her name because she may sue me. And she lashed out at me for being a sycophant. Now, at the time of a close friend's death, to be attacked for using a quotation from Shakespeare, and what is more, Shakespeare's full quotation is, "Good night, sweet prince, and may a flight of angels take thee to thy rest." I left that out. Mm-hmm. So I would say I do have very warm memories of my prime minister. I wouldn't call him a friend, but he was very good to me. And the compliment that he paid me, which I will forever cherish, was that when I overcame his resistance of close to 2 months on my leaving the Foreign Service to join him in politics, he said he agreed only after 2 months, but on condition that I came back to work with him as an officer on special duty. So I said, mm-hmm. Of course, I'd be happy to do that. And then he said, "You see, you're the only one to whom, when I give a task, you go away and never come back to trouble me except to say it's done." That was his opinion of me, and that was what caused this relationship to be shown. But also because television cameras accompanied us when we went on tour and when we were in public meetings, I was frequently shown there, and people got the erroneous image that I was a bumchum of Rajiv Gandhi's. I was not. I was just his joint secretary, and later, after I left the service, his special assistant as Congress president.
But the Hamlet reference is appropriate for this podcast, which is called The Literary City, because you are nothing if you are not very, very literary from all the writings that I have read. And in all the prose, or your prose that I've read either in your books or your articles, I keep sensing Woodhouse right through.
You're absolutely right. I learned my English not from William Shakespeare or Francis Bacon. I learned it from P.G. Woodhouse. And I used a phrase of Woodhouse's in a reaction which Rajiv Gandhi gave to the BJP walking out of the Lok Sabha, but not out of the Rajya Sabha. I gave him the phrase that they're clinging like limpets to their seats in the Rajya Sabha. It was pure Woodhouse. But it's amazing. That phrase follows me today, 32 years later. For some reason, they think we are calling them limpets. They don't understand the word "like". So when I said clinging like limpets, they said, "Ki aap hame janwar bata rahe ho?" What can one do? It's one of these issues that get lost in translation.
Speaking of translation, you are a politician in Delhi. You have fought elections in Tamil Nadu, and being multilingual is a job requirement, isn't it?
Well, it was when I used to attend Parliament as Rajiv Gandhi's aide in the 1980s, that I began realizing that parliamentarians, who were still English speaking in the sense that Somnath Chatterjee, Indrajit Gupta, Jaswant Singh, all these people spoke in English, but that basically English as a play of words was not being understood by anybody, and that they were much more comfortable with Hindi. So I started absorbing Hindi from the speakers whom I heard when I was not a member of parliament. And then when I became a member of parliament in 1991 and remained one with some gaps till 2016, 25 years later, I made it a practice to sit in the house and listen to outstanding Hindi orators. The three I have in mind were Prakash V. Shastri, who died in a train accident in 1975, then Atal Bihari Vajpayee, none of whose words I missed, and oddly enough, Uma Bharati, who is a fanatic, but a fanatic in fantastic Hindi. So I would sit there and listen to what they said and take down words that I didn't understand. And I made friends with a sadhu, a man who called himself 108 Swami Chinmayananda. He was a fellow MP, but on the BJP side. So I would meet him in the lobby, show him my list of Hindi words, and ask him what was the English meaning. And although he was a Swami, he was a very interesting man, because he was very keen and very zealous about visiting Middle Eastern countries. So he spoke a fair amount of English. So it was from Swami Chinmayananda in the lobbies, from Uma Bharati in the house, from Atal Bihari Vajpayee wherever, and from the late Prakash Veer Shastri, that I picked up my Hindi and have been able to make play with some of those words, sometimes to my extreme distress, as has happened twice with Modi. And my own party has not understood my play with the Hindi language and therefore even suspended me for 8 months and never gave me an explanation as to why I was being ignored. And now for 10 years, I have held no post in my party. The Congress has virtually thrown me out, but they can't throw the Congress out of me.
Quite appropriately, your book is titled Memoirs of a Maverick. Now there is a cohort or a companion book in the works, isn't there?
Yes, yes. There's a second book called The Rajiv I Knew and Why He Was India's Most Misunderstood Prime Minister. That was an integral part of the first book. But my publisher was of the view that this was biography, whereas my book was autobiography. So she tried to remove it. I resisted, saying nobody is interested in my life except for my association with Rajiv Gandhi. So we eventually arrived at the compromise that those pages, about 200 of them, would be published as a second book. And that is coming out, I think, in the week of the 15th to the 22nd January 2024. And then the second volume of my memoirs from 1991 to the present will be published, I expect, sometime towards the end of 2024 or early 2025. It depends upon how prolonged and agonizing the editing process will be. Because my editor is a very pernickety woman.
But that is a good thing, isn't it?
Punctilious to a fault. But I must say, at the end of the day, she makes the book look better. Well, her name is Chiki Sarkar, and she is the founder publisher of Juggernaut.
Well, I hope that after these books are done, you'll get back on my show as a guest again, and it'll be wonderful to talk about all the other stuff that you've written.
With the greatest of pleasure.
Most generous of you to spend your time with me today. I enjoyed it so much. And on that note, Manishankar Iyer, thank you so much for being my guest today on The Literary City.
Thank you very much. And I look forward to meeting you in Bangalore at the Bangalore Literary Fest.
You have been listening to one of the most significant political personalities from India, Manishankar Iyer, author of Memoirs of a Maverick, The First 50 Years. There's a link in the podcast description to where you can buy a copy of the book. And now, what's that word? That fun segment where we look at words and phrases that we use all the time but never stop to think about. That after this. Here we are. This is What's That Word, and this is my co-host.
Hello. My name is Praniti, but you can call me P. That's P with an A, not another E.
And hello, P with an A. Talk to me.
Right, that's what we do here. But enough said. Now to that interview with Manishankar Iyer.
Mm-hmm.
Enjoyable, fun, everything all at once.
Yeah, what was your takeaway?
My takeaway? So much. For one thing, I was keen to see how different this would be from the live session you guys did at Bookworm, you know, the one that you mentioned.
Yeah, right. And?
It was totally new. Even though some of the topics you discussed in that live session were the same, the angles of this conversation were totally new.
Yeah, they always are, aren't they?
And I enjoyed how you brought the whole narrative, you know, took the conversation through.
Well, thank you. I'm glad you say so.
It feels like you've done this a few times before.
Yeah, a couple of times. Hey, what episode is this? I only ask to remind you.
Number 68, not counting the live to public sessions. I'm kidding, of course.
All good. I enjoy it. All right, P with an 8, dive in. What's that word?
You know, it's so gray and lovely here in Bangalore.
Always is.
Right. Now, I was having a great time with my pals. You know, we were playing Scrabble in a cafe.
Nice.
And one of them needed to leave. But it was raining so heavily. And she remarked, it was raining cats and dogs.
Raining cats and dogs? Never heard that phrase before.
Yes, I know. It's an old cliche. But that's the point of this discussion. So let's talk about that.
Sure. This one's interesting.
Now, all I know about the meaning is that it means it's raining heavily. But how did cats and dogs come into this idiom?
Great. Now, as with a lot of idioms, the question of their origins falls to best guesses.
Right.
So etymologists look back to find out when that phrase was first used in a public forum, you know, like a book or published by any other means, like the transcription of a speech, you know?
Yeah, right.
And in this case, the earliest known use of cats and dogs goes back to the 18th century to Jonathan Swift.
Really? The Gulliver's Travels guy?
Yeah, completely. Among other things that he wrote, you know, Swift was a great author and an intellect of his time. And like many of his day, they wrote on diverse subjects. Maybe because there weren't too many others who could write with expression.
So little has changed.
Snarky. Okay, anyway, before the idiom was used in print by Swift, here's how the expression probably came to being. And to Occam's razor at all, the simplest explanation. You know, it goes back to the days of the thatched roof in England, which was quite common.
And very pretty.
Indeed. Now, cats and dogs also thought so, and they frequently climbed up into the roof and hid there because it was nice and warm and safe. And in heavy rain, the animals would either be washed right out of the thatch or rapidly abandon it for better shelter. I know, so it would seem like it was raining cats and dogs and therefore the expression.
How interesting.
Yes, there are other variants. One is that it's a Greek aphorism, which means an unlikely occurrence. That's all I know about it. And then there's the suggestion that the idiom is actually a corrupted version of a rare French word, which goes catadoupe, meaning a waterfall. You know, catadoupe, catadogs. So, you know, how it came through.
What rubbish.
Yeah, probably. And it has also been suggested that at one time, the streets of British towns were so poorly constructed that many cats and dogs would simply drown in a heavy rain, in a storm, and people would see the corpses floating by. They think that, oh, it's fallen from the sky.
Oh, no, that's just sad.
Sad? You're quoting Donald Trump?
Gee, thanks.
And there's some stuff about the Norse god Odin. In mythology, cats are said to have influence over storms and dogs' wind. And so the cat would bring the rain and the dog would bring the wind, and it rained cats and dogs, they said.
Ah, tempest-level winds?
Well, I had a dog who would let loose some noxious industrial-strength wind.
Charming.
Not so much when my guest looked at me with suspicion. And then I have to make a big deal about apologizing for the dog. And light a match.
Please stop. We're not doing fart jokes. Okay. Tell me about Jonathan Swift.
That old windbag.
Yes. That old windbag.
Well, okay. But people like to attribute the first appearance of the idiom, raining cats and dogs, to Jonathan Swift's book, A Complete Collection of Polite and Ingenious Conversation, published in 1738. And the quote went, "I know Sir John will go, though he was sure it would rain cats and dogs." But it appeared that Swift was quoting himself, because 30 years before that, in 1710, Swift wrote these lines in a poem titled A Description of a City Shower. "Sweeping from butcher stalls, dung, guts, and blood, drowned puppies, stinking sprats, all drenched in mud, dead cats and turnip tops come tumbling down the flood."
Wow. And what was the name of Jonathan Swift's 1738 book again? A Collection of Polite Conversation?
Not entirely. Okay, here's the full title of the book. Polite Conversation consisting of smart, witty, droll, and whimsical sayings collected for his amusement and made into a regular dialogue by Dr. Jonathan Swift.
These long and needlessly descriptive titles just crack me up.
Very SEO-friendly.
Yeah, I guess Swift was ahead of the curve. But did it ever rain anything other than cats and dogs? Not elephants, I hope.
No elephants. But this does remind me of a World War II ditty that my long past acquaintance, one of Bangalore's best-known journalists and a great guy, P.K. Srinivasan, said. In fact, sang, but badly.
Well, how did it go?
Well, it turns out, P.K. was embedded with the in the Middle East during the war with the British troops. And the British troops would sing this ditty. It went, "In Kuwait, in Kuwait, the birds, they fly high in Kuwait. The birds, they fly high, and they shit right in your eye. Thank the Lord that cows don't fly in Kuwait."
Thank you. Something to send to my troops at the pub tonight.
Better than karaoke.
I agree. Bye.
And that is our show. I'd like to thank my guest, Manishankar Iyer, and my co-host, Pranathi P. with an A. Madhav, and all of you for being here and for listening. Now hit that subscribe button, hit that like button, hit that love, just show us some love, and I'll see you again very soon. This is Ramji Chandran, and this is The Literary City.